Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Mr. Pop.
Hello, it's Royfield here. I am back in England, checking on my folks, making sure that they're all right in the pandemic. And I hope wherever you are, that you are also safe and with your loved ones also. Now, this is somewhat of a promo, this episode, though you do get about some 13, 14 minutes of the next 10 American Presidents episode, the one on Reagan afterwards. I have some news for your ears. Intelligent Speech is a conference which I put on last year in New York, and I had planned to have another Intelligent Speech back at the Center for Social Responsibility in Chelsea, New York this year. But of course, the COVID-19 pandemic has put an end to that. So what I've done is I've moved it online. So Intelligent Speech 2020, wherever you are on planet Earth, you can actually attend. And the whole idea of Intelligent Speech is it brings together the best educational podcasters to their listeners. And quite simply, it's going to take place at intelligentspeechconference.com. And it takes place on Saturday, June the 27th at 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. There quite literally will be 100 different topics for you to choose from during the conference. And it could be topics as diverse as the history of Byzantium, Black Lives Matters and what happens next, the American presidency, the evolution of the English language, or even the stresses and strains that spouses of doctors actually face. So there's going to be a whole plethora of different topics for you to choose from. Each presentation lasts for 40 minutes. So there will be a lot of different topics for you to view. Also, at any one point, there will be up to 4 different conference streams. So as I said, there's going to be a lot of content. there'll be solo presentations and also a series of roundtables, of which I will be participating in. There's also going to be a live episode of one of the shows that I do, Mid-Atlantic. Now, apart from that, David Petrucha, who did the FDR, TR, and the 1948 shows, I think that's all the ones that David did for us, will also be presenting. And he will be doing 1932, which I believe is the year of the rise of Hitler and FDR. Also, another one of our alumni, Professor Corey Brettschneider, who did the impeachment episode a couple of episodes ago, he will also be presenting. So specifically, if you are a fan of 10 American Presidents, there will be a lot of content relevant for you there. Now, you will be able to ask questions via text chat in the remaining 20 minutes of each presentation. So presentations are 40 minutes in length, of which you get 20 minutes at the end to ask questions. A one-day pass for the conference is currently priced at $10 for early bird tickets. Now, this will go up on Friday to $15. To purchase a ticket, quite simply go on to intelligentspeechconference.com and then go and click that buy button. Again, it's intelligentspeechconference.com, and then go and hit that buy button. If you want to have somewhat of a taster of some of the content that we have on offer, you can go onto Facebook and type in Intelligent Speech Conference, and you will see that I've been doing a lot of preliminary interviews with some of the people who will be presenting. Also, you can follow us on Twitter, where we are Intel Speech Con. So Intel double L Speech Con. So follow us there, where you'll get some of the latest news and views. We also do have the program live on intelligentspeechconference.com. Now, it will be subject to change all the way up to the conference, but I appreciate that, specifically for people who are not necessarily in the Eastern time zone. That's going to be a really important thing to know exactly when somebody's speaking who you really want to listen to, when they're going to be on. So the conference program is there, but keep checking it before we go live. Again, the website is intelligentspeechconference.com. Tickets are priced at $10, but will go up on Friday to $15. So get your tickets now, and I look forward to seeing you at Intelligent Speech 2020. Now, what you have is a bonus intro for the Ronald Reagan show. And what I'm going to do here is have three Ronald Reagan shows. So the first episode will be his life up until when he assumes the presidency. Part two will be the presidency until his death. And then part three will be a Q&A. But here you have a taster, because I'm only some 14, 15 minutes into the edit of episode one. I hope you enjoy it. And again, I look forward to seeing you at Intelligent Speech 2020 on Saturday, June the 27th.
Ronald Wilson Reagan, February the 6th, 1911 to June the 5th, 2004, was an American politician who served as the 40th president of the United States from 1981 to 1989. Ronald Reagan was born in the small town of Tampico in northern Illinois, and he spent the first 10 years of his life moving around many of the small towns of northern Illinois. His father, Jack, was a shoe salesman. Unfortunately, Jack had a drink problem, and this meant that he did not hold down jobs for very long. The family eventually settled in Dixon, another northern Illinois town, in 1920. Jack opened a shoe store of his own, but his alcoholism meant that he was never able to make it a success. Ronald Reagan's main influence on his life was his mother, Nell. Nell imparted her religiosity to him. She was a member of the Church of Christ, and she was an indefatigable optimist. And Nell imparted to Ronald Reagan his most important trait of optimism, his belief that things would always work out for the best. His father, Jack, also had an important influence on him, but it was a negative one. Ronald Reagan was determined that he would never fall into the same pit as Jack. This made him very disciplined, very hardworking, and very competitive throughout his life. Ronald Reagan had a very happy teenage life in Dixon, Illinois. The only cloud on it was his father's alcoholism. But that apart, Reagan became a very popular student in high school. He was an excellent sportsman, specializing in swimming, but his great love was football. And he found his first real girlfriend in the high school. Both of them would go on to Eureka College, which was a Church of Christ college in Illinois, a very small college. Reagan had no funds to support him. He largely existed on savings earned from his summer job as a lifeguard and the jobs he did around campus. Reagan got to Eureka just as the Depression hit the United States.
On Wednesday, October 23rd, 1929, the first waves of panicky selling began to drive down the price of blue chip stocks like Westinghouse and General Electric. The following morning, the fear turned to panic, and brokers began unloading margin accounts at record speed. Stock prices plummeted sickeningly across the board, spurring the rush of sell orders from terrified speculators still more. As anguished shrieks rose up from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, the visitors' gallery was cleared. In less than 2 hours, nearly $10 billion invested in stocks was simply wiped out.
The winds that blew in the 30s in the United States were winds to be remembered and then forgotten hurriedly, bowling through the dust bowls of the Middle West, scourging from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The winds of the Depression, as deep as it went deep. Days of the bonus army camping on Washington's doorstep, demanding decent treatment. Decent treatment meaning a living wage instead of an existence. In those first of the threadbare 30s, President Hoover had the unenviable task of leading the nation's administration.
The president began this campaign with the same attitude with which he has approached so many of the serious problems of the past 3 years. He sought to create the impression that there was no campaign on at all, just as he had sought to create the impression that all was well with the United States and that there was no depression.
Mr. Chief Justice, my friends, this is a day of national consecration, and I am certain that on this day my fellow Americans expect that on my induction into the presidency, I will address them with a candor and a decision which the present situation of our people impels. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Yeah. In actual fact, the Depression had hit northern Illinois much earlier because agricultural areas were in economic decline throughout the 1920s. But by and large, Reagan sailed through Eureka without doing much work, and he graduates at almost the depth of the Depression. But Reagan is so confident that he tells his classmates that in 5 years' time, he will be earning $5,000 a year. Now, this was a crazy shot at one of the worst times in American history. And he comes back to Dixon, and he doesn't know what to do with himself. And during his lifeguarding duties, he meets up with this businessman who's on vacation. And this man tells him, look, the most depression-proof industry in the United States now is radio. People are buying radios in growing numbers despite the depression. And Reagan sets out to build a career in radio. He begins by looking at the top radio stations in Chicago, but finds he can't get a breakthrough. So he decides to move off into the sticks, shall we say, and he makes a breakthrough by getting a test with a radio station in Iowa, the WHO radio station. And that is his entree to a career in radio broadcasting. Reagan's talent for best turning up for him begins here. Depths of the Depression, yet here he is moving into a new job in radio, and he's a great success at it after some initial slip-ups, but he becomes one of the radio's top stars.
To thank H. Fenwick Incorporated for kindly relinquishing half their broadcast period in order that you may hear a description of the World Series game.
This is the time when he is doing baseball commenting, and he knew very little about baseball. He hadn't actually been to a Major League Baseball game in his life, but he had the tape coming through from the Chicago Cubs Wrigley Field, and he would have to pretend to be at the game and make up things about the game, about what players were doing, about what the crowd was doing. And one time the tape went dead for 7 minutes, and Reagan had to invent a situation where the game was held up for 7 minutes because of foul balls, and the tape came back on and off he went. But he was very, very successful at it. But of course, Reagan being Reagan, it wasn't enough for him to be just a radio announcer and a sports broadcaster. What he really wanted to do was to get into Hollywood. The question was how. And he got the radio station to pay for him to follow the Chicago Cubs to their spring training camp near Los Angeles, as good luck would have it. And he managed to find somebody who knew him from Dixon, who was now working as a singer in Hollywood. She got him to an agent, telling the agent that here was the new Robert Taylor. Well, the agent touted Reagan to Warner Brothers, and Reagan was given a screen test at Warner Brothers, and it quickly became apparent that he was no Robert Taylor. But the Warner studio people saw something in him and decided that they would give him a temporary contract. Reagan went back to Dixon. The agent sent a telegram to say that he was going to be awarded a contract, but it was breakable at 6 months, and that it was barely more than he was getting now. But Reagan said, grab it before they change their minds. In 1937, Reagan says goodbye to Dixon and hello to Hollywood, California.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So this episode is somewhat of a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And what I'm now going to include for you is a conversation that I had with Professor Corey Brettschneider, who will be appearing at Intelligent Speech 2020. We had this live on Facebook. Corey's written extensively about the Constitution. We had a conversation about the current position of President Trump and the norms that he's breaking with his presidency. We tried to keep the conversation very non-partisan and really just look at historical precedent. It's about 20 odd minutes long. Hopefully you'll enjoy it, but again, what it is somewhat of a taster of some of the content which you can enjoy at Intelligent Speech 2020. So again, if you'd like to purchase a ticket, go on to intelligentspeechconference.com, that's intelligentspeechconference.com, and get your ticket today. Hello, Corey. We are live. We live in an unprecedented age in terms of the American presidency. You're a constitutional law scholar, so you study this stuff. I'm presuming that in terms of what you do, you're happy to be alive right now. Yeah. The amount of norms, stress testing that the American Constitution and the office of the presidency is actually going through right now.
Well, I often thought, may you live in interesting times. And, you know, Obama had some constitutional dilemmas that came up, some that we should have talked about, but he was a pretty great president. He was a constitutional law professor, and I was happy to play golf. I didn't feel like there were a lot of constitutional emergencies or hang out with friends. And these days I'm busier, certainly. I don't know if I'm enjoying it. I mean, I think it's quite frankly very frightening that this is, you know, sort of hypotheticals that we talk about in classrooms about the danger to democracy coming to life in the form of this actual person. And, you know, he's failed often, thankfully. He's been stopped sometimes by courts, more often by his own incompetence. But that doesn't, I think, hide the danger, and the danger in particular of his aspirations. So I wouldn't say I'm enjoying it. I'm mostly worried.
Okay, so explain to us, give us one instance where President Donald Trump, from a historical point of view, let's try and keep party politics out of it as much as we can. From a historical point of view, what is he doing which is breaking norms?
I think the most important and drastic recent example was the consideration and initial use of the military domestically. There's a long tradition of not allowing the president to use the military domestically. And there's a famous law called Posse Comitatus that talks about the limit of the military on U.S. soil. But as often happened with this presidency, there are ways around it. And this president almost instinctually goes for the most aggressive stance initially, and then we have to engage in this constitutional dilemma about whether or not he can be stopped. So when he used the National Guard to stop this protest in front of the church to secure his photo op, that certainly looked like, well, can he do that? And that was in Washington, D.C., so that's one exception. Another thought is that more generally, he has a law called the National, that he has legislation called the Insurrection Act that allows him to call up the military even over the objections of state governors if he believes that the states are unable or unwilling to protect fundamental rights. Now, I can tell you that he thought, and he had attorneys telling him, that he could use that law to overcome even objections by state governors and to say, send the military to New York to stop protests. I have been saying on radio and I'm writing something about why that's a misunderstanding of the law and why it's a misunderstanding of the role of the president. But it was really up to military officials to push back and to through the political process. We didn't thankfully have to see that come to the courts yet. But you know, the fact that he was even considering it is to me a shock to the system, and that he did this initial terrible thing, which was to use the National Guard and the military police in order to clear away basically space for a photo op to stop free speech, right to protest in order to do it.
So, okay, I have a little bit of an understanding of presidential history, not as much as you. And what I don't have is your understanding of the American Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, etc. But what is the difference? Why could General Washington don his uniform and try and put down Shay's Rebellion? Isn't that sending the U.S. military into a domestic disturbance? What's the difference between Shay's Rebellion and Donald Trump wanting to have a photo op outside of a church and needing to find his way there?
I mean, I think the main difference is that over time, you know, this is very early on in the history of Shay's Rebellion that you're talking about. It was a true emergency threat, and there probably wasn't the local ability to suppress it. I have to look into the details there. A lot of it would depend. Certainly, I think there's no question that a state can invite the military in. The constitutional question is over the objections of the state. So I have to look at whether or not local officials were objecting to the use of the military in Shay's Rebellion. I just don't know that offhand, but it's an interesting question. The other very famous historical example, of course, is the Eisenhower example, where former General Eisenhower did use the military, including the same unit that stormed the beaches at Normandy, to essentially go into Arkansas over the objection of the governor, who was, of course, blocking the entry of these Little Rock students into their school that they were entitled to go to as a result of a district court order. Now, that was in opposition to a local official. So the one real question that people have been raising is this like that? And my answer to that, you know, it's not going to surprise you, is no. That was an instance of the president of the United States using the military to take on a governor who was was refusing to enforce civil rights and was doing the opposite. And that's the way the act is written, is to allow the military to be used in order to enforce civil rights over the objection of a governor. What was the civil right that the president was trying to take care of to protect over the objection of a governor. If he was going to use the military to basically suppress police forces that were beating people up, I'd say actually that looks a little bit like the Eisenhower instance, but that's not what he was doing. He was doing it for general questions of stability that I think are not really handled by the act. And the there is a language in the act about basically the failure of a state's ability to take care of local insurrection. And that's just not what's happening now. It's protests. It's there is some violence, but I don't think it's out of the control of the governors to deal with it. So I just don't think that the analogy to Eisenhower works at all.
So specifically, I think the American military have been uncomfortable. We've had various ex-chiefs of staff just say, this is wrong. Constitutional law scholars, people like yourself, have said this is wrong. What is the immediate comeback on a president that let's say, breaks that norm?
You know, I should say, I think in constitutional law scholarship, as in the military, people are divided. I felt a kind of sense of urgency before. I don't mind sharing this. I had a piece under consideration from the Washington Post that turned out not to get in. What got in the same day was a military official is making a similar argument that the military isn't good at protecting free speech. But I felt the need to write it, especially before that piece came out, because so many law professors were just reading the act in the most literal kind of way without attention to the kind of civil rights that are really at stake in the act and that are behind it. And what they were really saying is, and this is the comeback too of the administration, it's up to the president, that this gives a lot of power to the president, this Insurrection Act, to decide when states are unable to do their jobs and to send the military in. And it really is a sort of grant of almost an authoritarian power to the president. So I don't want to pretend that, you know, there isn't a comeback or that this is an easy question. It really isn't. And I've spent a lot of time reading the statute. It was pulled back at one point. There was much broader language that was pulled back. So that's part of the debate, I think. The other thing I've got on my side is during the Bush administration in his second term, there was a memo written about an earlier memo all about the Insurrection Act. The first memo written by John Yoo, who defended, of course, the president's torture as legal, said the president can use the Insurrection Act at will, basically, and civil liberties have to be subservient to questions of insurrection at the president's judgment. And the second memo from the Office of Legal Counsel said, disregard the first. That's very dangerous, what John Yoo was saying to us. And even though we're in the same administration as him, we've got to really care about civil rights and the right to protest and the right to free speech. So, the Constitution is a very fragile thing. It's easy to collapse it. And that's why I'm trying to do my best to speak out against it. And you made a great point in the beginning, which is we don't want to be partisan when we're talking about this. And kudos to George Bush in his second term in his Office of Legal Counsel for really providing us the best argument against Trump's ability to use the military domestically.
Sounds to me, being a Brit, that your president almost has the power of a monarch. And surely the whole point of your, if he can call in the military whenever he wants, wherever he wants or she wants, that is surely one of the founding things that you guys fought against. Is this a symptom of the imperial presidency, that what was initially envisaged, the scope and the role of the presidency has got bigger in the preceding 200 and plus years? And maybe if the position is open to so much interpretation, that maybe there needs to be another amendment to the Constitution, which clearly defines and checks and locks the power of the presidency, because otherwise he's wearing a crown. And for what it's worth, our British Queen could not pull out the military to go anywhere within the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I mean, you're identifying the central dilemma. The first thing to say is that the Insurrection Act can be clarified through ordinary legislation. We don't need an amendment to the Constitution. We can just have a majority of Congress. The president, of course, has to sign on to it to limit the ability of the president to do this. And I think that's something that certainly should be done, because the fact that there's any ambiguity here does open the possibility of imperialistic, an imperial presidency, and that kind of way of acting. In a broader frame, you know, Schlesinger, of course, coined that term, used it in his book, The Imperial Presidency. And his story is really, we had a great limited presidency, and then, you know, early in the Republic, and then late in the Republic, Johnson and Nixon create this imperial presidency. And in my new book that I'm writing, I tell a somewhat different story, which is that we've really had kind of constant struggles between presidents who have acted in an imperialistic kind of way, and then periods of time of recovering from them. And there's no better example, for instance, in the Adams presidency, which was a kind of imperialistic presidency, I think. So we've got those two strands. And yes, the key is to, exactly as you say, to restrain the president so he can't act like a monarch, or she.
Okay, so specifically, that's one instance where he called in the military to be on the streets of Washington during the President George Floyd protest, the Black Lives Matter protests. But you have at least another two ways where Donald Trump has broken with presidential norms. So why don't we jump into the second one?
I was just going to say on this one, on the same, you know, broad question, in addition to the calling into the military in the case to clear the church, another example to me that really was frightening was I listened in depth, and anybody can listen to it on The Daily, for instance, excerpts of, to now public phone call between the president and governors. And he's threatening them. I am going to do this. And he's using, I think, that photo op to just show that he means it, that he's going to go in and use the military in this way. I'd say a second, though, if we're going to switch topics and go to a different issue. The president has a personal attorney who's making an argument on his behalf in a case in New York in which the local district attorney, Cyrus Vance, is trying to get Donald Trump's taxes. The argument in response to that has been a sitting president not only can't be subject to criminal indictment, something that I'm happy to talk about, but can't actually also even be criminally investigated. And in the Second Circuit, that lawyer was asked the following question: what if Donald Trump really did kill somebody on Fifth Avenue? Could he not only be indicted, but couldn't be investigated? And the lawyer said yes. Now, that case is before the Supreme Court. It's this generation's U.S. v. Nixon. Of course, in U.S. v. Nixon, for those who listen to our impeachment podcast, was a case in which the president was subpoenaed for information in an ongoing criminal trial. And the court basically said, yes, the president has some privileges, but the president isn't above the law. And 8-0 made the president turn over the Watergate tapes that led to the end, eventually, of the Nixon presidency. Now we're revisiting it. To me, that clearly says, yeah, a president can be investigated. The Nixon case, you know, was 8-0. But I don't think this case is going to turn out necessarily to be 8-0. There's Justice Kavanaugh, for instance, who's been very pro executive power, pro, in your terms, imperial presidency. And you know, I worry. I think the oral argument went pretty bad for Trump. I listened to it in depth. But it is possible that they can do a variety of things, including send the case back for more consideration and delay, delay, delay. And as the Manhattan District Attorney said, in this case, look, there's a 5-year statute of limitations. And if the Trump people succeed, and even if they don't win, if they can delay 5 years, they're going to win just because the time's expired. So that's also, I think, another example of what you're talking about, a kind of imperialistic threat to the rule of law.
Okay, so I find this utterly fascinating that you Americans are so, you revere the Constitution and understand from a historical point of view, the American Constitution is groundbreaking in that it's the first constitution of any nation state. You know, up until that point, England just evolved, Denmark just evolved, the Zulu Kingdom just evolved, it just was. There were certain norms as to how that polity is governed, but it was never written down. And that's what happens when the rebellious British colonists decide they don't want to be British colonists anymore. They want to now be Americans. Got it. But it's fascinating for me, considering how much you revere the Constitution, and it has these various amendments, 26 or 27, I can never remember now, And it's seen as a document that holds ultimate truth, pointers to behavior that the various levers of American governance should govern America by. But it's open to so much interpretation. Is that the strength of the Constitution historically, or is that the weakness?
Yeah, I was thinking that the whole time, that I was going to say exactly, you've identified the strength. And, you know, go back in time. So, you know, I'm previewing a little bit this book that I'm working on now. The hero to me of the book is, is not to me, you'll see in the book, is the constitutional theory of Frederick Douglass. He's the constitutional hero. And part of what I'm saying is that the brilliance of the document is that because it's so much about values, and it is written in these broad and vague ways, that allows dissenters, people who have been left out, to claim their rights. So as much as the presidency matters to our republic and to the protection of the Constitution, in fact, the presidency matters much more than courts, which have historically undermined the Constitution, worked with presidents when they've been undermining the Constitution, failed to protect the Constitution from presidents. So it really is largely about the person in office. But I'd say the second thing that matters most is not courts. It's what I call constitutional constituencies and constitutional constituents, citizens who are able to say, to look to those principles and say, hey, I'm going to claim this for myself. And there's no better example of that than Frederick Douglass in his life, but also in his constitutional theory, which was all about what I'm saying. And he says, you know, look, if you look at the principles early in the Republic, there is, for instance, a ban on children inheriting the punishments and crimes of their parents. There can't be, in the Constitution's word, corruption of blood. And he uses that to say, you know, that looks like it's a kind of narrow, weird thing. But no, it's about a principle of equality. And that's the principle that was identified by Jefferson in the Declaration, and that's been so terribly betrayed by the actual people in power since the founding of this country. So Douglass, in a sort of brilliant move of constitutional interpretation, is doing exactly what we've said. And Jefferson himself, to go back to him, was an opponent of the idea that courts should have the exclusive monopoly on interpreting the Constitution. He said, look, if you leave it to courts and you see the document as sort of technical, it'll be like a thing of wax that can be molded into whatever the people in power, five justices, you know, well, at the time it wasn't five, but a majority of justices want it to be. And that's not what it is. It's an independent set of moral ideals. You know, he had influenced it, of course. He wasn't there for the writing of it, but he certainly wrote the Declaration. And his point was, you know, Matt, my friend Madison and I, who basically wrote much of it, we know as much as the courts when it comes to what it means, and we can claim it. And then Douglass is doing that one better and saying the right thing, which is, no, citizens actually probably do it the best. And it's citizens, I think, arguing and telling presidents how to act that gives us our best moments in history.
We just have a message here from Luke Baxter. It says, sorry, I missed the start. What's the overall theme of this discussion? I believe we're talking about the ways, Luke, in which the current president of the United States has at least tested existing norms of what the president should actually do. And we're trying to be as non-partisan as possible and trying to look at historical precedent for this. Corey, interestingly, you mentioned the Constitution being used by people which it has left out. Maybe you could inform us of the recent Supreme Court justice ruling and how that has taken, let's say, a 1960s view of discrimination and updated that for 2020? Because I think that goes to really answer your point there.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great moments of what I'm talking about, certainly in history, and it's a brief moment, is Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson, of course, working together to pass the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Now, that's not a constitutional act. It's an act of Congress, but it's the realization clearly of an ideal that was set out during the Reconstruction period and never really guaranteed. The technical, there's a lot of interesting constitutional law about the 1964 Act. It was upheld under the Commerce Clause rather than the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. But to my mind, it's really about the ideal of equal protection. But it also does something that courts at that point had not done, which is guarantee the rights of women. And that brings us to the current case. act included a ban on discrimination, firing really, and employment based on sex. That's the language that's used. It was at the time largely thought to be about gender equality. And there's a weird history of how it got passed, where it's basically a coalition of conservatives who wanted to destroy the bill by putting this poison pill in it, and feminists who are like, let's go for it. And of course, it gets through. So the question before the court is, well, does this 1964 act also extend to transgendering and gay people? And, you know, Justice Gorsuch was put on that court to basically do the opposite, to try to limit gay rights. He was thought to be a religious fundamentalist. But he's also a textualist. And the way he read that act, he said, look, the question is pretty simple. Does sex discrimination include discrimination against transgender people, against people who choose to be with members of the same sex? And he said, yeah, pretty clearly, that's the same idea. And it doesn't matter if they knew that. I just read the text for what it is. So that is actually a hopeful moment that this president, who was really trying to control the court, I guess, and that's not so much norm-defying, that's probably pretty typical, was met with a pretty good example of a justice turning on him and doing to me what the law says rather than what the president wanted.
So, Corey, you spoke at Intelligent Speech last year when we had the physical conference in New York. You're going to be joining us this year on June 27th, which is going to be a virtual conference. What are you going to be talking about, sir, and why?
I'm going to talk about the presidency and the Constitution and the history, really, of how presidents have attacked the Constitution and the surprising way that we've recovered, not through courts, which really have almost never been there through the American people, but through a combination of citizen demands, citizen interpreters, pressuring presidents to do the right thing.
Fantastic. Corey Brett Schneider, constitutional law scholar and professor at Brown's University. I've got that correct.
I've got
all of your credentials out there. Thank you for coming on to Intelligent Speech. Speaking live, it's great that we had a few people watching us and leaving comments. So we've been live on Facebook. And if you've missed the start of this, you can just, when we get to the end, hit play again. And you can also see this stream on YouTube. Don't forget, you can go on to intelligentspeechconference.com and purchase a ticket for the conference, which is happening on June the 27th. Tickets are only priced at $10 for 8 hours of intellectual entertainment. Thank you, Corey.
Thanks, Roy Fell.
Robin Pearce from the History of Byzantium podcast.
Ryan Stitt, the host and producer of the History of Ancient Greece podcast.
Jen McMenemy, ancient history fangirl.
Samuel Hansen, host of the podcast Relatively Prime Stories.
Peter Adamson, the History of Philosophy podcast.
Jamie Redfin. Benjamin Jacobs.
David Petrucha.
Eric from Reconsider.
I'm Eric Marcus.
Jenny Williamson.
Zachary Davis.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Intelligent Speech 2019 in New York City was a blast, and I am thrilled to announce that I will be back again for 2020. But due to the COVID-19 pandemic, it'll be online this year at intelligentspeechconference.com.
Intelligent Speech is an online conference that brings together the best educational podcasts and their listeners, and it is taking place this year online only at intelligentspeechconference.com from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time on June 27th, 2020. There will be approximately 40 of the best educational podcasters available that day, presenting a wide range of topics as well as roundtable debates from several of us. And listeners will be able to fully participate online, including being involved in Q&As with all the presenters and more. A one-day pass for the conference is currently priced at $10 for early bird tickets. So for more details, go to intelligentspeechconference.com and see you there on June 27th.
We shall never surrender.
This will be an event that you don't want to miss, so I hope to virtually see you there at Intelligent Speech 2020.
By any means necessary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.